Chapter 5. The Secret Life of Charlie Wilson. No one questions the modern politician's reliance on spin doctors, press secretaries, and image makers. It's such a common practice that it can be stated as a virtual law of political physics that under normal circumstances, politicians will always emphasize the positive and never deliberately create a negative public image for themselves. What always set Charlie Wilson apart was his impulse to do just the opposite. Invariably, he promoted his vices and hid his virtues. As late as 1996, the New York Times would all but dismiss him in an editorial as the biggest party animal in Congress. If Wilson made it hard for the Times to recognize the power and influence he wielded in 1996, it was nothing compared to the public face he projected during the early 1980s, when he seemed to be little more than a public joke. He almost never spoke on the House floor. He wasn't associated with any legislative initiatives. In this regard, his cover was nearly perfect. But what every professional in the House of Representatives knew was that simultaneously another very different Charlie Wilson was at work. He was, in effect, running a tunnel right into the most powerful places in Washington. If there was such a thing as an underground ladder in Congress, then Wilson was climbing it speedily, so much so that Washington Post columnist Jack Anderson included the Texan in his list of the Capitol's 10 most effective backroom operators. Wilson was a genius at the inside game of maneuvering in the balkanized world where power is distributed in blocks and where deals are made when you have something to trade. And ironically, because Wilson was such a political pro, his outrageous lifestyle seemed to actually enhance his position. For one thing, from the very beginning, everyone in the House knew who Charlie Wilson was. He was impossible to miss. Too tall, too handsome, too loud, with too many striking female staffers by his side. He'd first broken from the pack and become a part of the legend of his party in 1976, when he'd defied his own Texas delegation and maneuvered his way onto the all-powerful Appropriations Committee. That move had made Wilson a player, one of 50 House members with a vote on how the government's $500 billion annual budget would be spent. The committee's power is so great that its 12 subcommittee chairmen are known collectively as the College of Cardinals. The full committee holds the purse strings of the entire federal government, but it's such an immense job that responsibility for the various branches of government are broken down and delegated to individual subcommittees. In the end, that means that a lone appropriator who stays on a committee long enough and knows what he wants can amass extraordinary individual power over agencies and the policies they pursue. To most members, the payoff for winning an assignment to appropriations comes from the fact that there is no better place in all of Congress to find pork. The man from Lufkin never shied from using his influence to get jobs for his constituents or contracts for local industry. He took enormous pride in reviving the fortunes of his poverty-stricken district. But just milking the system for all it was worth was not what had drawn Charlie Wilson to Congress. He had a grander vision. His passion since boyhood was foreign affairs, and from the moment he got on appropriations, he set out to position himself on the two subcommittees that dole out all money connected to national security. His Jewish friends had helped get him onto the committee. Once there, Charlie learned from these master politicians how to influence budgets and policies. When he won a seat on the Foreign Operations Subcommittee, which allocates all U.S. military and economic assistance, he was suddenly positioned to champion Israel's annual $3 billion foreign aid package. And, since this subcommittee rules on the State Department's expenditures abroad, overnight he became one of 12 congressmen the State Department could no longer afford to alienate. In fact, these 12 legislators are treated as patrons who must be curried and pampered by ambassadors and even secretaries of state. In 1980, just after being re-elected for a fourth term and only a few weeks before his Las Vegas weekend, Wilson struck again, maneuvering himself onto the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. Now the Pentagon and the CIA were added to the list of federal bureaucracies that could no longer treat Charlie Wilson as a mere mortal. The twin assignments were his tickets to play in the arena of world power. He was given the highest security clearance and an extra staffer and ushered into the soundproof hearing room under the Capitol dome, where he was shown his permanent seat. one of 12 large black leather chairs grouped around a horseshoe-shaped table. The room is closed off to the public as well as other members. Very little is ever written about what goes on when the 12 members meet in this chamber, but each year they preside over a kind of secret court where huge deals are cut and important policies made or broken. Since hundreds of billions of dollars are at stake, and since only so many programs can be fully funded, enormous pressures and inducements are brought to bear upon these 12 men. It's a big government, and everyone has a favorite weapons system or spy satellite, an embassy to be refurbished, a rescue mission to be funded, and assets to be traded. The White House, the defense contractors, the military services, fellow congressmen, all maneuver around and encircle the appropriators, seeking their support. Each year, in effect, the lobbyists create their own power list, a ranking indicated by the dollar amounts they dole out to congressmen in campaign contributions. Charlie Wilson was always at the very top of this list, usually occupying the second spot right below his intimate friend John Murtha, chairman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. Anybody with any brain can figure out that if they can get on the Defense Subcommittee, that's where they ought to be, because that's where the money is, Wilson laughs. Once I got on defense, I went from being the skunk to being the prettiest girl at the party. To the future speaker, Jim Wright, Charlie Wilson was now critical for getting more contracts for the F-16s being built in Dallas-Fort Worth. For Texas Democrat Martin Frost, it was the B-2 bomber. Wilson made it easy for his colleagues to come to him, always gracious, almost always helpful. He was quickly accumulating powerful allies and IOUs. He was also playing a far more interesting and effective insider's game in areas of the House that were not visible to outsiders. "You've got to look at the House like a college class where fraternities are everything," explains Dennis Neal, a Washington lobbyist who is one of Wilson's oldest friends and allies. "If you're not in the right fraternities, you're not in the game, and no one is in so many different important fraternities as Charlie Wilson." At the time, Neal was one of the Capitol's greatest manipulators of Congress in the foreign affairs arena. His firm, Neal & Company, represented clients like Egypt, Pakistan, Morocco, and Jordan. His job was to get them U.S. money, weapons systems, and good press, to do damage control, and provide influence in the corridors of power. One way he did it was by making campaign contributions and giving favors to congressmen on the committees that control foreign aid. He didn't waste his time or money on members who don't count, and in the foreign affairs world, he considered Wilson one of the two or three who were indispensable. When Neal starts ticking off Wilson's memberships, it quickly becomes apparent how his network of congressional fraternities later allowed him to speak for the entire House when he and Avrakatos set out to radically escalate the CIA's Afghan war. "The way things normally work, if you're not Jewish, you don't get into the Jewish caucus," Neal says. "But Charlie did. And if you're not black, you don't get into the black caucus. But Charlie plays poker with the black caucus. They had a game, and he's the only white guy in it." Part of the explanation here is that the House, like any other human institution, is moved by friendships, and no matter what people might think about Wilson's antics, they tend to like him and enjoy his company. His friendship with the insular black fraternity began with Barbara Jordan, the charismatic congresswoman who electrified the nation in 1973 with her stirring remarks during the Nixon impeachment proceedings. The two had served 6 years together in the Texas State Senate before coming to Washington. Former Speaker Jim Wright remembers how everyone initially came to know who Wilson was because he always sat next to Jordan on the House floor. This tall, good-looking cowboy and his constant companion, the dour, heavy-set, scowling black woman. "I was her best friend for the whole 6 years she was here," Wilson recalls fondly. And for the mostly male black fraternity that played poker together, a group with a different set of priorities than Barbara Jordan, something about Wilson's lack of piety and his bad boy aura appealed to them. Wilson's arch-conservative friend, Republican Representative Henry Hyde, identifies it as the Adam Clayton Powell factor. "Adam Clayton Powell's people loved him because he was always sticking it to the man, and Charlie is down there creating his own ground rules, and in a weird way he's kind of a white man's Adam Clayton Powell. There is a kind of nonconformist relish about him. He leads the sort of life that many congressmen envy but wouldn't dare emulate. When Lewis Stokes, the low-key black chairman of the Intelligence Committee, was arrested for drunk driving, Wilson turned it into a raucous act of friendship with one comment. "Mr. Chairman, I want you to know that I deplore the racist attack that the police of the District of Columbia just made on you with that totally fabricated charge."